Welcome to This Week in Christian History, a podcast from the Center for Christian History at Mississippi College. The Center for Christian History is dedicated to expanding knowledge and understanding of Christian history. Our mission is to provide a scholarly, unbiased look at the events, figures, and movements that have shaped Christianity over the centuries. You can visit centerforchristianhistory.com for daily historical highlights. And each week on this podcast, we'll do a deep dive into key moments with Christian history's leading authorities. We are pleased to have the Christian History Institute sponsor this episode of the podcast. Find free resources and subscribe to their magazine at christianhistoryinstitute.org. On February 13, 1793, Christian Schwartz died. We all know William Carey for his missionary work in India, but he was not the only important missionary to that nation. Christian Schwartz was a Lutheran missionary from Prussia. He immersed himself in Indian culture by learning several languages so he could converse with Muslims. He died on February 13, 1793, after ensuring that the next generation of Indians could sustain the work that he began. And on February 14, 278, Saint Valentine was beheaded. The story of Saint Valentine has lasted two millennia, yet no one is quite sure of the correct details of the story. The Catholic Church struck the story from its list of feasts and removed it from its calendar in 1969. The most accurate story seems to be that around 270, the Roman Emperor, Claudius the Cruel, had trouble finding men for his army. So, he decided to ban all marriages and engagements, thinking that the desire to marry was preventing men from enlisting. Despite the emperor's edict, a Roman priest named Valentine refused to stop marrying couples. As a result, the emperor had Valentine beheaded on February 14th, 278. Finally, we reach the subject of this week's deep dive. Lew Wallace lived perhaps one of the most impressive lives of the late 19th century. He held several prestigious titles, including New Mexico Territorial Governor, Ambassador to the Ottoman Empire, and Union Army General, and he served as a military judge at the trial of Abraham Lincoln's assassins. He also wrote Ben-Hur, A Tale of the Christ, which has been called the most influential book of the 19th century. After a life of great success, Wallace died in Crawfordsville, Indiana on February 15, 1905. Today, Nick Walters, director of the Center for Christian History, talks with Thomas Meeks of the Wallace Museum for the life and times of this fascinating figure.
Hi, this is Nick Walters, the founder of the Center for Christian History at Mississippi College. We are glad to have yet another conversation about something very interesting that happens this week in Christian history. And we are talking today with Tom Meeks, who is the Associate Director of the General Lew Wallace Study and Museum in Crawfordsville, Indiana, to talk about General Lew Wallace and a famous book that he wrote. Many people who don't probably, Tom, don't know the full title, right? Which is Ben-Hur, A Tale of the Christ. And Tom and I are going to have an opportunity to talk today about General Wallace and about the book as well. So Tom, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, and thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. Well, tell us just a little bit before we actually talk about General Wallace being able to talk about the book. Tell us about the center that's there in Crawfordsville and how that all came about.
So right now I am sitting in General Lew Wallace's study. It is today a museum, but it's a building he built late in life after he wrote Ben-Hur. Built it with the money he made off Ben-Hur.
Okay.
To be a, as he said, a pleasure house for his soul. He wanted a place where he could just bury himself in a den of books and paint if he wanted to, play music if he wanted to, his violin, read, of course, write, and not be bothered. Kind of wanted to put himself in seclusion in here so he could focus on his work.
How about that? And so is it kind of a spot behind his home, or help us with the visual? Is it down a couple of blocks away, or
so we are what was his home is unfortunately no longer there. there is a house there, but it's been remodeled extensively. He built this building, though, basically in his backyard. There was a spot he loved to write outside. Now a statue stands there, and but before the statue was a big beech tree, beautiful beech tree, and he loved to write under it. He would set up a platform with a rocking chair and a lap desk, sometimes build a tent over it, and he loved to work outside if he could. And just 20 feet away from that area, he eventually built this building. And now, like I said, today it's a museum. It became a museum in the 1940s. And before that, it was owned by the family, but it kind of acted as a museum, but it didn't officially become one until the 40s. So.
How about that? Well, great. Well, tell us more about Lew Wallace, and kind of just give us some background on him and some of the really cool things that he got to do. My gracious, all the different things that one human did in a lifetime. No wonder he's got a museum to him for all of that work that he did. And then let's talk a little bit more about that, about specifically, you know, let's talk about Ben-Hur and how that came about.
Sure. So Lew Wallace, and I'm a biased person working here, but to me, Lew Wallace is an American hero. He is a Renaissance man, first and foremost. He could do almost anything. He could approach almost any topic and do it well. He's born on April 10th of 1827 to David Wallace and Esther French Test. Esther French Wallace. Okay. Unfortunately, when he's a boy, his mother passes away when he's about 5 years old. Mm. His father, about that time, was lieutenant governor of Indiana. When he turns nine, his father's elected to be the actual governor. So as a boy, his father, you know, he loses his mother at a young age, and his father is so busy with politics that he's not around that often. So Lew, as a boy, is able to just, you know, raise himself. He loves adventure. He loves to explore the untamed woods of what was then frontier Indiana. He wasn't particularly good at school as a boy. He, tells stories in his autobiography about getting hit by teachers. There's one story that I find hard to believe, but apparently on his first day of school, a little girl next to him ate his pencil. Literally ate the pencil, so the teacher punished him for not having a pencil. There's another one of my favorite stories of his boyhood, and you know he's got to be 13 at this point. He runs, his father's in office in Indianapolis, so Lew is living in Indianapolis with his father, and he runs away from home because he loves adventure. You know, he wants to get out there and experience the world. He runs away from home to attend the Tip Canoe and Tyler II speech by William Henry Harrison, one of the most famous presidential speeches in U.S. history. And he goes to attend it, runs away from home as a 13-year-old boy. So he's very politically in tune from a young age, probably because his father was governor, but loved adventure. As he gets older, the Mexican-American War breaks out when he's about 19. He joins that. After the war, he starts practicing law. He gets married to Susan, and when we get into Ben-Hur, I can elaborate a little on her, but there is no Lew Wallace without Susan Wallace. She is so important to him. It's, you know, everything he ever did, he attributed to her. So he gets married, and in the late 1850s, he's involved with politics, and he's involved with a militia company, and that militia company gains statewide fame. So as 1861 comes around and the Civil War starts to break out, the governor then, Oliver P. Morton of Indiana, calls on Lew Wallace because he knows his name from his fame as a militia leader, and makes him the adjutant general at the outbreak of the war, and charges him with recruiting all of the men. You know, Abraham Lincoln calls for 75,000 volunteers. Well, Indiana's quota was 6,000 men. Lew starts sending out telegrams, flyers, contacting everybody in Indiana he can to recruit. And the quota was 6,000 men. Well, 13,000 showed up to volunteer their services. So he was tasked with organizing them into their regiments. Well, Lou told Oliver Morton, I will accept this position, but only under the circumstance that I am given command of one of those regiments. So he takes command of the 11th Indiana at the outbreak of the war, about a week after organizing 13, just the logistics of organizing 13,000 men in a week. Throughout the Civil War, though, he's the colonel of the 11th early on. He's promoted to brigadier general. Fort Henry and Donelson happen. Shiloh, he's promoted to major general after those. Shiloh happens, and he has a big falling out at Shiloh. I suggest reading some of that stuff, too. That's probably the biggest stain on his military career, but it can be argued. It's been argued by historians for, going on 150 years now, 200 years. So he's put on the shelf after Shiloh and taken out of active duty. He would sit on the Buell Commission during that time. He would help with the siege of Cincinnati during that time. But then Abraham Lincoln himself personally puts Lou back in charge of some troops in Maryland, puts him in charge of the Middle Department, gives him control of about 6,000, 8,000 troops in the state of Maryland. And then the Battle of Monocacy happens. That's probably the battle he's most famous for outside of Shiloh. After the war, he's involved with two of the most controversial and high profile trials in U.S. history. He's part of the Abraham Lincoln conspirators trial. And then he's also part of the Henry Wirtz, Andersonville prison commandant Henry Wirtz trial. He's the president of that one. Again, both of those very significant, very controversial today. In the period after the war, he's looking for a way to get away from practicing the law. He, at this point in life, detested the law. So he resigns his commission from the United States military and joins the Mexican army, is commissioned there by Benito Juarez and the Juaristas to help Benito Juarez retake control of the Mexican government. Many, many Civil War veterans did that, I believe, on both sides. I could be wrong. And then he begins writing. We can get into that here in a little bit. But in 1878, Rutherford B. Hayes, President Rutherford B. Hayes, makes him the territorial governor of New Mexico. While he's in New Mexico, he deals with Billy the Kid and the Lincoln County Range Wars there. He deals with some of the land disputes with Victorio and the Apaches. After New Mexico, at this time it's called minister, but today we would know it as an ambassador to the Ottoman Empire or Turkey. And while he's in Turkey, he forms a very close relationship with the Sultan. They were true friends with each other. During his time there, he travels to the Holy Land. He travels all throughout that empire there. Eventually comes home and builds the study not too long after that we were talking about. So,
well, that's about what time period is that he's back from the Ottoman Empire?
So he comes back 1885.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. All right. I'm sorry.
That when he's coming home from there, he actually writes his wife saying, I want to build a study. I want this pleasure house for my soul is where that quote comes from. And it would take him 10 years, but in 1895, he eventually builds the study with the money he makes off of Ben-Hur.
Okay. All right. Well, talk about that for just a minute. I'd love to be able to make sure everybody understands how a guy that's just got this, as you say, a Renaissance man, right? I mean, that's got so many things going on in his head that made him even want to be able to write the book in the first place. I mean, how did that germinate?
Yeah. So relating back to his childhood, he was not the greatest student. He absolutely hated math. but he loved to read and write. He loved to read. I mean, and as I said earlier, he loved adventure. So he could almost project himself into these faraway worlds through reading, you know, read a novel and project himself into that to kind of satisfy that need for adventure. Mm-hmm. You know, he's, again, looking for ways to get away from practicing the law. So he starts after the war writing, and he picks up a book that's called The Fair God. He had been writing it for nearly 30 years, put it down, picked it up, put it down, picked it up. And after the war, picks it up and finishes it finally in 1873. And that book, again, called The Fair God, is all about the Spanish conquest of the Aztecs. Mm-hmm. It dealt with a lot of the discovery of the New World, and how the Aztecs, it's written from the Aztec point of view and shows how they perceived these Spanish conquerors at the time. From there, though, he gains some confidence after that's released. It's released and does fairly well, not what Ben-Hur would do, but he begins thinking, well, what can I do next? What can I write next? And from as far as he could remember from being a boy, he was always fascinated with the story of the three magi, seeing the star in the east, receiving the message that Jesus, you know, that the new king of the Jews is born from the star of the east. So he is fascinated with this tale, but he has all these unanswered questions. He was told that tale by his mother as a boy, but has all these unanswered questions. Who are these men? How did they travel across the desert at that time? How did they receive a message from a star? You know, so he starts writing this piece, and he thinks early on that this piece is going to be just a magazine serial, just a series of, you know, articles that come out in a magazine every month that have illustrations with it, what have you,
sure,
to tell the story of the three magi. As he is in that process, he's realizing, oh, the birth of Jesus, this is a really good beginning. You know, this is a start of a big story, the birth of Jesus. And then he starts thinking, well, what's the logical end of that story? The crucifixion is what the logical end is. And if you follow through Ben-Hur, that's what it starts and ends at. But as with the wise men, he had all these unanswered questions about the people, the politics, sure, the culture of the time. And he realizes that, well, Christians will not accept a story in which Jesus is the main character. They will be very offended by that. Some will consider it as blasphemy. And this is in the 1870s.
Sure.
Different than it is today. So he starts filling in the time between the birth and the crucifixion with these stories of people, these stories of the politics, these stories of the culture of that time. And that's where he starts making that transition to the story of Judah Ben-Hur.
You can watch the rest of Nick's interview with Thomas Meeks on the Center for Christian History website at centerforchristianhistory.com. We are pleased to have the Christian History Institute sponsor this episode of the podcast. Find free resources and subscribe to their magazine at christianhistoryinstitute.org. This Week in Christian History is produced for the Center for Christian History by Blue and Gold Media at Mississippi College in cooperation with the MC Department of Communication. For episode transcripts and more information, visit centerforchristianhistory.com. Be sure to subscribe on Spotify, Apple, YouTube Music, or wherever fine podcasts are found. Our next episode is coming next week. Thank you for listening.